He considered his moral obligations to be of an altogether different class than those of lesser men, and so rarely felt shame or compunction, except in very general terms. He went through Lord Aback's chest swiftly and methodically, handling each item and then replacing it exactly as he found it. The trunk contained largely items of stationery, letter sets, seals, ledgers, books of law, and all the necessities that might furnish the desk of a Member of Parliament. Lord Aback's clothing and personal effects had presumably been packed elsewhere, for the only item of clothing in this cedar chest was a woolen scarf, which had been wrapped around a rather ugly brass paperweight in the shape of a pig. The trunk carried with it the smell of the sea, a briny odour, less salty than sour. But its contents were hardly even damp. Mercifully for Lord Aback, the trunk must have been spared a full immersion. At the bottom of the trunk was a leather briefcase. Moody opened it and withdrew a sheaf of papers, all of them contracts, receipts, and bills of sale. After several minutes' searching, he found the deed for the sale of the bark Godspeed, and pulled that document free of the others, handling it carefully so that the legal seal did not crumble or pull away. The contract had been signed, as Lord Aback had attested to Balfour 3 weeks ago, by a Mr. Francis Wells. The date of the sale also corroborated with the politician's story. The ship had changed ownership in May of 1865, 9 months prior to the present day. Moody bent closer to look at the purchaser's signature. Francis Wells had signed his false name expansively. The inscriber had made a huge looping flourish on the left-hand side of the capital F, so large that it might have been a letter of its own. Moody squinted at it sideways. Why, he thought, in fact, that flourish might have easily been a C cursively joined to the next letter. He peered closer. There was even a dot of ink between the C and the F, a dot that one might have taken for a spatter if one glanced at the paper carelessly, which seemed to suggest that Carver had signed the name deliberately ambiguously so that it might read either Francis Wells merely or C. Francis Wells. The penmanship was rather shaky, as often happens when one writes very slowly, wishing to ensure a particular effect. Moody was frowning. In June of the previous year, Francis Carver had been in possession of Crosby Wells' birth certificate, a document that proved, as Benjamin Lerventhal had attested, that Crosby Wells' middle name was Francis. Why, Moody thought, it was plain enough. Francis Carver had stolen Crosby Wells' birth certificate with the intention of posing as the other man. The ambiguities of this bill of sale must surely be deliberate. If Carver were brought to court on the charge of false impersonation, he could deny that he had ever signed it. Was the shared name Francis merely a happy coincidence, or could Wells' birth certificate have been falsified after the fact? A middle name would be very easy to add to any document, Moody thought, and one could easily use a lighter shade of ink, or fade the word somehow, to mask the fact of the later addition. But why should Carver have wanted to falsify his own identity, most especially upon a bill of sale? How could it have been to his advantage to use another man's name? Moody reviewed what he knew about the matter. Francis Carver had used Crosby Wells' identity when speaking to Benjamin Lerventhal in the office of the West Coast Times in June, but he had not used Crosby Wells' identity when confronting Alistair Lord Aback the month before. To Lord Aback, he had called himself Francis Wells, and then he had signed his name with deliberate ambiguity. Bearing in mind Lord Aback's mysterious belief that Crosby Wells and Carver had been brothers, Moody could only assume that Carver had posed as Crosby Wells' brother in his dealings with Lord Aback. As to why he might have done such a thing, however, Moody had no idea. He scrutinized the bill of sale for a long moment, committing its particulars to memory, and then returned it to the briefcase, slotted the briefcase back into the trunk, and continued with his methodical investigation. At length he was satisfied that the trunk contained no more clues that were of use to him, and in a gesture that was partly idle, ran his fingers around the edge of the lid. All of a sudden he gave a murmur of surprise. A slim package, squarish in shape, had been slipped beneath the calico lining so that it lay concealed between the cedar and the cloth. He bent closer, and his fingers found a neat slit in the fabric, roughly the size of the span of his hand, and delicately hemmed so that it would not fray. The calico lining was stamped with a tartan pattern, and the slit in the cloth was cleverly disguised against the vertical stripes of the tartan, which ran flush with the edge of the trunk. Moody wormed his fingers into the cavity and withdrew the squarish object that his fingers had located. It was a wad of letters, tied with string. There were around 15 letters in total, each addressed to Lauderback in a plain and unsophisticated hand. Moody took a moment to memorize the look of the knot and the length of the strings of the bow. He then untied the ends, tossed the string to one side, and smoothed the folded letters over his knee. He could see from their postmarks that they were arranged in reverse chronological order, with the most recent letter first. He shuffled to the back of the pile, selected the very first letter that Lauderback had received, and began to read it. In the next moment, his heart jumped into his throat.
Dunedin, March 1852. Sir, you are my brother, though you do not know me. Your father sired a bastard, I am that bastard. I was raised Crosby Wells, taking the surname of my parish priest, not knowing my father, but knowing myself a whoreson. I passed my childhood in the Newington Hall House, the Jewel. I have lived a modest life, such as I am able, as a man of little means. I have not suffered. However, I desired always to see my father, just to know his shape and voice. Finally, these prayers were answered with a letter from the man himself. He had always known of me, he wrote. He expected he would soon be gone, and confessed he would not identify me in his will for fear of tarnishing his name, but he enclosed me £20 and blessings. He did not sign his name, but I made inquiries about the servant who had brought the note and tracked his carriage, though it was a rented one, to Glen House, your father's house, and yours. I bought a coat, I shaved, I took a gig to your father's house, but, sir, I could not ring the bell. I returned home distraught and cowed, and then I made a blunder, seeing in the shipping news that Alistair Lauderback, lawyer, was departing for the colonies next tide. I believed it was my father. I did not know he had a son. I did not think that son might share his name. That ship departed, but I was sharp upon the next. I landed at Dunedin, and began to make inquiries as my fortunes would allow. I attended your public address, the one conducted in the rain upon the wharf, where the harbour-master made you a present of a pocket-watch, and you seemed very well pleased.